Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
1 year ago today, President Obama signed the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, $787 billion for economic stimulus projects like tax cuts, education, unemployment benefits, and infrastructure improvements. We've actually used about $270 billion so far, so was it money well spent?
I think ironworking is experiencing a rough time right now. You know, I think there's a lot of fear, and maybe the stimulus money, if it does kick in, maybe they can go ahead with these jobs.
Out on the main streets of America, the story of the stimulus seems to be inconclusive.
Same sad story, that's a fact. One step up and two steps back.
Making slow progress, standing in place, inching backwards. There's no GPS to track the stimulus money. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, February 17th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with Todd Zwillick, who's filling in for John Hockenberry. We just heard Pete Herman, who's an iron worker who's thumbs down on the stimulus. We're going to talk to someone else who's thumbs up on the stimulus. You know, the takeaway here is we don't know if the stimulus worked yet or not.
We don't. With $787 billion in size, it's almost impossible to know, especially how it's affecting individual Americans, which is the most important part. Well, more on the one-year anniversary of President Obama's stimulus package in the stories this morning. This morning, the White House is out with a new report saying that $787 billion plan has been on target and effective. Vice President Joe Biden says the plan created or preserved 2 million jobs, a number that's almost impossible to verify. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says it's not surprising that the stimulus plan doesn't do very well in the polls.
You've just lost your job. Your wife just lost their job. You're having trouble figuring out how you're going to pay for your kids' college. And somebody says, how's the Recovery Act work?
Well, let's ask someone how it's working. Charlie Dilbert is a highway worker, and he joins us from Cincinnati. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning.
Charlie, we spoke to you and Pete Herman, that iron worker from New York, just a few months ago. You both told us different stories about the stimulus, but Pete said the stimulus is a bust. What grade do you give the stimulus act?
I give it about a 7 right now.
A 7 out of 10?
Yes.
And you got a job from the stimulus act?
Yes, I have.
And you're still employed?
Well, right now I'm unemployed. I've got some training I got to do at the end of the month here for a company that I was working for before. And also, I should be going back probably, I'm hoping, the end of March or the mid part of April.
Pretty soon. Okay, stay with us. We're going to be back with you in a moment.
Toyota's troubled winter continues today. This morning, we're learning the automaker's considering a recall of the Corolla because of possible power steering problems. The Corolla is the world's top-selling car. Speaking just hours ago, Toyota's president said all future Toyota models will have a brake override system that could fix the acceleration problems behind the recent global recalls.
And in Afghanistan?
He needs tracers! Tracers!
U.S. Marines and Afghan forces continue to battle the Taliban on the streets of Marja. The fighting is still fierce in some pockets, but U.S. officials say the Taliban resistance appears to be more disorganized with every passing day. NATO says 4 service members have been killed in the assault so far. For the first time in this fight, U.S. troops are firing non-lethal smoke rounds to disperse fighters in an effort to save civilian lives. Looking at the markets, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 10,268. The S&P opens at 1,090. And the NASDAQ starts at 22:14. We are covering the Winter Olympics all this week, and how skaters stay covered up. I don't think it's about being covered up. Sometimes it's about being uncovered. The fashion of figure skating. We're going to talk to former Project Runway contestant Nick Varios later this hour.
And the stimulus bill was signed into law 1 year ago, but as we've just heard, not everyone thinks it's working. We get an update with correspondent Andrea Bernstein on the stimulus in just a few minutes. But what do you think? How is the stimulus performing in your neighborhood or not? We want the story of your neighborhood at 8778MYTAKE. You can post it to the website, thetakeaway.org. More on the stimulus in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
1 year ago today, this was the headline.
The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that I will sign today, a plan that meets the principles I laid out in January, is the most sweeping economic recovery package in our history.
That is President Barack Obama as he signed the stimulus bill. In the last 12 months, the federal government has gotten $453 billion out the door in spending and in tax cuts. The money's been used to keep teachers at work, build bridges over rivers, extend unemployment benefits, and thousands of other government efforts to save the economy, like road building. What do we know about how well it's worked? We're asking what you think and what you're seeing in your own neighborhood at 8778-MY-TAKE.
My name is Frances Anthes, and I work at a community health center. We've really seen the effect of this economic stimulus. It's allowed us to expand in some cases, or at least to hire new staff. We're seeing more people than ever because we provide high-quality care to a lot of people who don't have health insurance or who have been laid off.
We're hoping to get your reports of what you're seeing in your own community in the stimulus. Leave us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. I'm joined now by Andrea Bernstein. She covers transportation issues, the stimulus bill, infrastructure, which means you get to read a lot of reports, right, Andrea?
Reports are me.
So the newest report we have tells us how the stimulus money has been spent.
That's right. Vice President Biden, who's been sort of put in charge of the implementation of the Recovery Act by the president, put out a report last night. And in the report, he says that they have $453 million out the door and that they have created or saved 2 million jobs. Now, there's a really interesting line that you don't often find in a report like this. It says, notwithstanding this progress, the nature of the Recovery Act remains misunderstood by many and misconstrued by others. Critics have suggested the entire $787 billion is being spent on earmarked programs. In fact, he says, it's mostly gone to tax relief and then direct aid to states and individuals, which have basically prevented both state budgets and individual budgets from cratering.
Right, and a lot of that went to help the state budgets refill their unemployment coffers, right, to keep paying unemployment,
right,
benefits.
I mean, in poll after poll, Americans really don't like the stimulus because they think of it as something that's building a road for somebody else. And they don't connect that everybody got a tax cut, or 95% of Americans got a tax cut, that many people who are unemployed have gotten their insurance benefits extended, have gotten unemployment insurance extended. And these things are very, very hidden. So the administration finds itself sort of digging out of a public relations hole saying, look, it's really been going well. See?
Well, we are joined again by Charlie Dilbert, a highway worker from Cincinnati, Ohio. Charlie, we talked to you on October 30th. Are these things hidden for you? I mean, you yourself are getting a job out of the stimulus, but what about the people around you?
I see there's some people things are starting to work. I was talking to a fellow the other day, and he was telling me that he works for the railroad, and you know, they move a lot of commerce and a lot of things, and he's telling me that traffic is up. You know, they're hauling steel, they're hauling a lot more goods and stuff. So if that's part of it too, that means that there's people that are working, the people that are starting to benefit from this, just not only construction workers and other people, that it's coming. And I think a lot of people need to be real patient. They're jumping the gun. Americans like to have everything real fast,
Well, you're one of those Americans, Charlie. And I'm not saying that you want to have things fast, but you are American, and you can maybe emphasize, as Press Secretary Robert Gibbs did, with people who are still unemployed and therefore feel like the stimulus plan isn't working because they don't have a job.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, the government's putting this money out there to kickstart the economy. We need other industries and other businesses to start, saying, okay, now we've sat on the sidelines long enough and we've watched everything. Now we need to start participating. And I truly think that's coming. I mean, private sector is going to be part of the government's plan to, push this thing along, too. It's just not all about the government. I don't believe it can be.
Well, Andrea, part of the PR problem for the stimulus bill has been these changing numbers, all these different reports coming out saying that we don't actually know how many jobs it's been created. Some of these numbers are wrong. What makes this so difficult?
Well, there have definitely been growing pains. I mean, one of the things that happened with the Recovery Act, coming as it did on the heels of the bank bailout, was that there was this huge pledge, we're going to be transparent, we're going to say everything that we're doing, unlike the bank bailout, which has pretty much zero transparency. as a result of that, people are trying to fill out these forms, and some people understand it, and some people ended up putting up all the jobs in their companies, not the ones that were created by the Recovery Act. And these things were very easy to spot, and there were many news stories about it, and we did some of them. But the White House is saying, you know, you need to look at the sort of the created or saved picture. And, you know, the thing that Charlie was saying about Americans like to have everything come real fast is a problem in the Recovery Act, because if you look just at the projects, the concept of shovel ready, well, that is, okay, you're going to get it fast. It's ready to go. But what's ready to go? Not necessarily great things.
Well, shovel ready is kind of a problem because some of these projects require states to match what they're getting from the government, and states are broke.
Right, absolutely. And for example, in the state of Virginia right now, there's a tussle between the federal government and the state because the former Democratic governor didn't have a lot of projects in the pipeline to get going with the Recovery Act.
Andrea, it's also a problem of just plus minus, isn't it? I mean, the economy has, the bottom line is the economy has shed 3 million jobs or so since the recession started. Hard to make the case, well, we've created X number when you look at the bottom line, minus 3 million.
Right, exactly. And the White House really dug itself into the hole when at the beginning of its term, it said that the economy, the unemployment rate was going to top out way below what it is now. So now they're constantly explaining how they got that wrong, and they're sort of involved in that big debate rather than being able to point to what they see are the successes of this. And it's coming, as you know, in the right as they're debating a new jobs bill. They're not saying the S word in Washington
right.
anymore because that has been sufficiently blackened. So
now
they're talking about
the S word.
A jobs bill.
Well, Charlie Dilbert from Cincinnati, Ohio, you described yourself as a poster boy for the stimulus. I guess we can't use stimulus, but for the stimulus bill. Are you the exception, do you think, where you are?
Not necessarily. Like I said, there's the union hall I belong to, there's still a lot of men and women that are still unemployed and stuff right now. And from what I'm hearing and talking to people, it's coming. There's work that's coming. Some of it's stimulus related, some of it's not. And it's going to take time. You know, I see a lot of people in our neighborhood, you know, they're working, they're going to work every day. I mean, it's, you know, we're here shoveling snow and stuff. So it's kind of crazy here anyway. But I feel like things are, you know, they're going to start happening. And, you know, it's coming. It's just, you know, it's going to take time.
Charlie Dilbert, highway worker from Cincinnati, Ohio, and Andrea Bernstein covers transportation and stimulus whatever you want to call it, for the takeaway. And we're asking you listeners out there, give us your report from the ground. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at thetakeaway.org. Let us know what you're seeing in your own community. And at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the top stories.
Toyota says it's considering another recall, this time because of possible power steering problems with its best-selling Corolla model. A senior Toyota official says the details of the problems are still unclear, and the company has only received around 100 complaints. Now, in the past few months, Toyota has recalled more than 8 million cars worldwide over problems with braking and unintended acceleration. Meanwhile, NATO soldiers continue their offensive in the Afghan city of Marja today. One Afghan official says Taliban fighters are using women and children as human shields. Turning to Haiti now, costs from January's devastating earthquake are adding up. Andrew Powell from the Inter-American Development Bank says damage estimates are now more than the entire value of Haiti's economy.
For the death toll and the intensity that we're talking about, something of the order of $8 billion.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy is scheduled to visit Haiti later today.
Here at home at the Westminster Dog Show last night, Judge Elliot Weiss announced the new champion.
Preston's show at the 134th Westminster Kennel Club is going to be the Scottish Terrier.
Sadie the Scotty!
Sadie is the eighth Scotty dog to win at the show since it began in 1877. I just have to mention, that's a Michigan dog. Finally, a bizarre story from Britain this morning. Police have arrested a broadcaster with our partner, the BBC, who admitted on air that he'd killed a lover who was dying of AIDS. The police say Roy Gosling was being held on suspicion of murder. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up. I just can't get enough of that theme, right? We're going to cover the Winter Olympics, a little bit about the fashion of figure skating with fashion designer Nick Varios. You may know him from Project Runway.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Hey, you want that to go?
I'm Todd Zwillick, and it is time for Takeouts, the top news stories that we want you to be following today and this week. First up, Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, is in studio as usual. Now, Louise, the world is focused on the European countries and on Greece's deficits and the Eurozone, but domestic analysts are paying attention to Washington and the U.S. Treasury today. What's going on there?
Well, Todd, you wouldn't believe, you know, after I wrote an article this weekend about Greece's debt, how many reader emails I got from people saying, let's not be all high and mighty here. The U.S. has right. quite a big debt problem. And a lot of people today will be watching when the Treasury announces the monthly deficit figures for January. It comes out every month. December was the worst month on record. Just for that month, we had a deficit of $91 billion. This is bringing up our year-to-date close to $400 billion. And at this rate, our interest costs just for our debt are skyrocketing. And economists estimate that by 2014, we'll be paying $516 billion just in interest every year, which is more than all of our spending on domestic programs.
Just on interest to service the debt. And Congress just had to raise the debt limit to something in the $14 trillions, correct?
Right.
Okay, so this is obviously a political football that gets kicked around in Washington. The administration will say, yeah, we're spending to get out of this recession. We're spending to create jobs. Is that fair?
Well, you know, more and more studies are showing that we're really going to have to cut spending, increase taxes. You know that there's this commission that the president plans to announce on Thursday, a bipartisan commission to look at how to reduce the debt. They'll come up with some recommendations. The other thing that you need to be watching is what are foreign countries doing with regards to their holding of our debt? Because we are reliant. And one thing that went little noticed, but it came out yesterday, is that the December figures for foreign holdings of our debt, it showed that China sold $34 billion of their debt, and that made them no longer the largest holder of our debt. Now Japan is. China became the largest holder of our debt in September of 08, right at the beginning of this crisis. So this shifting is something to watch, and you need to make sure foreign countries are holding it.
As the president tries to deal with debt and see if the other side, Republicans, will even participate, Louise Story, our reporter on Wall Street and finance from The New York Times, thanks.
Let's check in on Vancouver right now, where John Branch is covering the Winter Olympics for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome back to the show, John.
Thank you.
A couple big things going on right now. Snowboarding, men's snowboarding about to begin. What is it looking like for there in terms of medal winners?
Well, tonight is the men's halfpipe competition, and I think anything other than a Shaun White gold medal will be considered one of the bigger upsets of the games.
Because we haven't seen him enough.
Right.
Exactly.
But the big story today is really skiing, women's downhill. We've got the Lindsey Vonn. She's injured, and people are wondering whether or not she's going to be able to perform at her top.
That's right. She had she had banged her shin against the inside of her boot during a wreck a couple weeks ago, and there was talk just a few days ago whether or not she'd be able to ski at all. She is skiing. She's a little sore, but the downhill is her event, and kind of like Shaun White, she's the prohibitive favorite, and it'll all depend on how well she can kind of handle this this injured shin.
Is there someone else who's hoping to maybe take advantage of this and come out on top?
You know, she has several rivals, including some good friends. Maria Reiss is one of them from Austria. And, you know, the one thing about skiing, and it's probably different than the halfpipe and snowboarding, is that the course can change very much. Anybody can really come out of nowhere. All it takes is one, you know, stiff breeze when Lindsey Vonn goes over a jump, and suddenly she loses a few one-hundredths of a second, and suddenly she's not in first place. So skiing has a lot more variables than people probably give it credit for. So to see Lindsey Vonn not win a gold medal would not be a huge surprise.
Okay, John Branch is a sports writer for our partner, The New York Times, covering the Winter Olympics from Vancouver.
Our last takeout comes from you, our listeners, and how to turn your hobby into a business.
My hobby is traveling, and I would love to be one of those fortunate souls that is allowed to travel, get it paid for, and turn it into a TV show. Doesn't really matter what the format would be. That would be my ideal hobby job.
Yeah, you and me both. We talked yesterday about ways you can turn what you love to do into how you earn a living. That's one of the many stories we got.
Here's another one from Mark in New York. He posts to our site, after 25-plus years in IT, I was laid off in August. I combined my high-tech background with my love of architecture and design to create a new business. It uses software tools to create 3D animated models of homes and apartments. Those models help architects, contractors, realtors, and individuals visualize what their home might look like with a little imagination.
Bobby went to our website too, and she writes, "I'm a very good photographer and an excellent Photoshop artist." Now, apparently, photography is a big hobby that many of our listeners also want to take up.
My name is Chris Padgett. I'm calling from Boston, Massachusetts. I lost my real job earlier this year, and I've taken up photography full-time. I'm actually on my way to shoot two different things right now, in the car, in the snow, on the way. And I got to tell you, I'm not making a lot of money right up front, but it's awesome.
All right, Chris, that sounds great, but Gene has a piece of advice before you take up photography.
My name's Gene, and I'm from South Jersey. I'm a professional photographer, and I'd sure like to turn this profession into a hobby. Nice warm beaches, maybe a little sand on the camera, no clients, no art directors, no kids, no BS.
Okay, Gene might be having a bad week.
See, this is, you know what, Todd, this is the danger when you take your hobby and you turn it into a job, because it's something that you love, but you love it when you don't have to do it.
Have to do it.
In order to make money.
And then go back to your real life.
Exactly.
You can tell us about anything that's on your mind, including what hobby you'd love to have as a job, 8778MyTaker. Of course, you can post to the website, thetakeaway.org.
Gene could be on the nominations for who's having a bad week, but we are taking your nominations for who had a good week, who had a bad week. We announce the winners on Friday with our friends at The Week magazine. You can give us your nominations at 8778MyTake, and tune in on Friday to hear who turned out to make the cut. Coming up...
To meet our growing energy needs and prevent the worst consequences of climate change, we'll need to increase our supply of nuclear power.
The nuclear power option for Georgia. What this means for the environment and the local community, that's coming up in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we talk about the first new nuclear power plant being built in the United States for over three decades and what they may mean for the local communities where they're being built. That's in a few moments. Right now, let's check in on top stories at 31 minutes past the hour. Fierce gun battles between United States Marines and Taliban fighters continue into their fifth day in the Afghan town of Marja. This comes as the Afghan brigade commanders say Taliban fighters are using civilians as human shields in the fighting. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Rod Norland, correspondent for our partner The New York Times in Kabul, who told us U.S. soldiers are focused on avoiding civilian casualties.
Right down to the platoon level, the soldiers really have taken on board this message that, you know, civilian casualties are a dumb idea in this kind of war.
Meanwhile, in Iraq, the number of American troops has dropped below 100,000 for the first time since the war began. Meanwhile, Toyota's troubles continue this morning with no end in sight. The automaker is considering a recall of the Corolla because of possible power steering problems. The Corolla is the world's best-selling car. Toyota's president said all future Toyota models will have a brake override system and that the company will hire new quality control officers to conduct testing on every vehicle.
It's a one-year anniversary today of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or as you probably know it, President Obama's stimulus bill. This morning, the White House is out with a new report saying the $787 billion plan has been on target and effective. Vice President Joe Biden says the plan created or preserved 2 million jobs, and that's a number that's very hard to verify.
It's taken a while to get out of this ditch, but it's working. It's working.
Also today, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood is expected to announce that $1.5 billion will be given to states and local governments for major transportation projects. President Obama is also expected to assign an executive order today, establishing a bipartisan deficit commission similar to the one rejected by Congress. And at the Olympics, the U.S. men's hockey team beat Switzerland 3-1 in its first game, a surprising victory for many. And the American men's curling team, ranked fourth in the world, lost 7-5 to Germany last night, back on the ice today when taking on Norway. Germany has overtaken the U.S. in the medal count with 9 total to 8 for the U.S. Let's check on the markets. Asian and European markets are up. Futures also up. The Dow will start at 10,268, the S&P at 1,094, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,214. Those are some of the stories you're following this morning.
We are announcing roughly $8 billion in loan guarantees to break ground on the first new nuclear plant in our country in three decades.
Radioactivity,
President Obama spoke to a crowd of union officials yesterday and announced that he has approved an $8.3 billion loan to help have two nuclear reactors built in Burke County, Georgia. We should point out that Kraftwerk was not standing behind him singing that. That was a little bit of our own artistic license there with the president. This is part, however, of President Obama's clean energy campaign to help create jobs and become energy self-sufficient. Now, of course, nuclear energy cannot be mentioned without some controversy, in fact, a lot of controversy. So is this announcement the start of a new wave of nuclear energy in the United States? We want to put that very question to our guest, Gary Golden. He's a futurist and blogger for the Energy Roadmap. Gary's in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Nuclear power, I grew up in the shadow of Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. Nuclear power making a comeback makes this person nervous. I remember those days. Are we looking at a new wave of nuclear power in America?
So nuclear energy has not stopped being controversial. And while this is a significant shift in policy, the economics of nuclear power generation remain very uncertain.
Very uncertain. So we can put $8.3 billion up in loan guarantees, but it doesn't prevent necessarily rate hikes or tax hikes or cost overruns in building a plant. We don't know where that's going.
Yeah. So, you know, people think this is a government-backed loan, but really it's the private sector that builds nuclear power plants.
The private sector builds
the private sector.
So why is the president making an announcement of 8.3? What does he have to do?
Well, what prevents nuclear power plants from being built are permits and financing. And what the loans do is they give investors confidence that the government is backing these new generations of nuclear power plants.
So, Gary, we haven't built a nuclear power plant in this country in 30 years. Where are we going to get the brain power and the engineers to build this plant? We're going to have to borrow them from France, where nuclear power is still really popular?
Yeah, so one of the challenges is the United States kind of missed a half of a generation of training the talent for advancing nuclear engineering. So the hope here is that this does spark construction of power plants, but the inspiration might be based off of new nuclear power generation techniques.
When you talk about whether this is questionable economics here, are you talking about whether or not nuclear energy is a viable, cost-effective power source?
So it depends on which side you stand on. So costs there's operating costs, there are capital costs, and there are different investment strategies associated with nuclear power generation. But utilities are highly regulated, and they generally find the investments to do what they need to do.
And our portfolio is about 15% nuclear nationwide already, right?
About 20%.
About 20%. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we have to talk about nuclear waste. Where I work in Washington, there's a constant debate about where to put the stuff. Some people want it in Nevada. Of course, it's not going there over Harry Reid's dead body, he says. And there are debates everywhere about how to transport this radioactive waste. Is there anything new in nuclear waste that's going to change the conversation about whether we should just bury the stuff?
Yeah, so it's important to note that we are really in very early days with our understanding of nuclear science and engineering. And the idea of just simply putting this nuclear waste in a place is kind of dated. And what the Department of Energy and entrepreneurs are looking to do is to develop ways of using this nuclear energy waste as a fuel source that they can then reuse these bundles from traditional power plants for new forms of nuclear power
generation. Okay, but we're not quite there yet, and I want to turn to somebody who's probably been thinking about this, Mayor George DeLoach of Waynesboro, Georgia, where these plants are going to be built. Mayor, good morning.
Good morning.
I know that you're probably excited about the jobs, but let me ask you about the waste first. Are you ready to have the fistfights over transporting this stuff to through the counties next to you or the states next to you? They're not going to want to see your waste going through their territory.
Well, we really haven't given that much thought. You know, we're right next to SRS, which is a nuclear facility in South Carolina, and they have a disposal, I think, over in Barnwell, South Carolina, where they keep low-grade waste now. Mm-hmm. But we're hoping, you know, the president will find a place to keep our nation's nuclear waste. But now we're just tickled to death about the 3,000 to 4,000 jobs that it's going to provide for our area.
Well, I want to ask you about that. 3,000 to 4,000 jobs, that's in construction, right? What
yes.
about in the long term?
Yes, that's construction. The permanent, I think, the permanent number would be around 850 to operate the Unit 3 and 4. We already have Unit 1 and 2 in operation, and there's about 800 to 900 people operating that in the county. And so anytime you add 800 to 900 more permanent residents, you know, that really has a economic effect on your on a small community.
Now, Mayor, amid the red, white, and blue bunting and the White House security advance and all the pageantry, do you have concerns in your community about how this is going to be paid for, potential rate hikes on existing customers, or tax hikes at some point? Is there any concern about that?
I don't think so. I think it's going to be about a 9% increase in the residential rates.
Well, that's a lot, isn't it?
Well, no, I don't think so, okay. Really. When you see what we're paying for gasoline now and oil, I don't think it's that, you know, that expensive, no.
All right.
We want to get dependent, you know, away from foreign oil, and this is, I think, the best way to generate electricity is by nuclear power.
Mayor Gary Deloach of Waynesboro, Georgia, where they're building nuclear power plants. Gary Golden, you're shaking your head. Quickly, why?
Well, I think it's important to note that the transportation fuels or gasoline transportation fuels are not in competition with natural gas and coal and nuclear to generate electricity.
So that's utilities versus transportation,
exactly.
But all part of the overall energy portfolio. Well, say one thing for nuclear. It's not a fossil fuel. The president's promoting nuclear power. Gary Golden, futurist and blogger. Thanks for joining us.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Todd Zwillick.
It's like being married to her, you know? Yes, honey. No, honey. Whatever it is you want is fine with me. And it's good. It's worked. Works in real life, too.
That's Gabriel Rangel. He's not talking about his girlfriend there. He's talking about Sadie, the dog he handles. She's the Scottish Terrier who took home Best in Show in the Westminster Dog Show. Joining us to talk about it is Sarah Montague, reporter for WNYC Radio. She's been covering the dog show for decades. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sadie, I want to ask you how she won, but first let's give a say to Judge Elliot Weiss, who knows why Sadie won Best in Show.
She thinks very highly of herself, and she looked at me and as if to say, you know, enough already. You know I'm special. Just go give me the ribbon. I mean, it was that kind of look, which is typical Scottish Terrier, and that's the breed character you want.
Sarah Montague, when you looked at Sadie, did you get that impression?
I absolutely did. In fact, the clip you just played at the top of the moment was from a conversation I had with Gabriel on Sunday at a charity brunch, and I said, Scotties are incredibly opinionated and self-willed. How did you get her to buy into this? And he said, basically, it's a marriage. I just do whatever she wants.
Whatever she wants. You know, to a lot of outside observers, the Westminster Dog Show appears to be sort of a canine four-legged fashion show. Is it something more than that to these judges and the handlers?
Much more than that, and I've always thought that was an inaccurate comparison and that the more interesting one was more like the Olympics without the tasks. Most of what's being judged here has nothing to do with beauty per se. It has to do with dogs being bred for particular tasks and particular kinds of performance, particular ways of relating to us in our world, and looking at each one and saying, does that one come up to that standard? Is that the best Scottish Terrier I can see? Is that the best Chihuahua? Is that the best Mastiff?
But a working dog like a Border Collie who's bred for a task doesn't get to herd a bunch of sheep on the floor at the dog show. So how does he meet that standard?
The standards have to do with physical type. So what the judge is looking for, and if you watch this on television, you can see how they're kind of being patted down as if they're going through customs. They're looking for bone structure. They want to see that the shoulder is free and can move freely. They walk them back and forth. You watch them running them across the tarmac. That's to see if they move freely, if their hips work properly. They hold their heads to see if they can move properly. Depending on what the breed is, there's something that each judge is looking for, and he has or she has that picture in his mind.
Now,
I was going to say, yeah. Sarah, you got to see the photos of our takeaway dog show. Clearly, most of these are dogs that would not, they're not pure breeds, many of them, but they're also not bred to be show dogs. The Benny was the winner of the takeaway dog show, and here's a clip from the owner.
Up until recently, though, he was a little overweight. Actually, the vet had him listed as obese, as a Chihuahua. He was up to almost 9 pounds, and they're supposed to be about, I think, between 5 and 6 pounds.
Benny, probably not standing a chance at the Westminster Dog Show.
That is true. And in fact, in some respects, the only way in which I would say the fashion show comparison makes any sense is these dogs are beautifully kept and fit, and it does help, I think, owners of any kind of dog to remember this is an animal with a body. It's a mammal. Cherish it. Love it. Don't overcute it. Don't overfeed it. Don't let it lose its natural dignity by turning it into a possession or an accessory or something you're not paying attention to.
Many of these dogs, I have to say, sort of they cute themselves enough, especially the ones on our website on thetakeaway.org. Sarah Montague, reporter with WNYC, who has spent many years covering the Westminster Dog Show, helping us cover the dogs, the working dogs, the show dogs, and of course, Sadie, best in show.
From Michigan.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley. I'm here with Todd Willock, who's filling in for John Hockenberry this week. Coming up, our Winter Olympics coverage continues with how figure skaters choose what to wear on the ice. What goes into that decision? Because it's become a high fashion parade out there on those skates. We're going to talk about the fashion of ice skaters with fashion designer and former Project Runway consultant Nick Varios. That's coming up in a few moments. But first, let's check in on the headlines at 47 minutes past the hour. It's the anniversary of President Obama's stimulus package. Today, the White House will release a report on how it fared. Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says the stimulus has been a success, but he admits some Americans aren't seeing the results yet.
You've just lost your job. Your wife just lost their job. You're having trouble figuring out how you're going to pay for your kids' college. And somebody says, how's the Recovery Act work?
Also today, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood will announce $1.5 billion in new spending on major infrastructure projects. Staying with transportation, Toyota may add a new recall to its recent problems, this time over a steering problem on the Corolla model. Meanwhile, Toyota's president says he will not attend a hearing on Capitol Hill about the company's safety issues.
The Obama administration has nominated a new U.S. ambassador to Syria. This comes 5 years after his predecessor was withdrawn in protest at the assassination of Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. Washington suspected a Syrian hand in that murder. So why is the Obama administration seeking to restore ties at this moment? Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC, joins us from London to explain. Jonathan, why is the United States taking this approach to Syria now?
I think really because Syria remains an important player in the region. Washington's efforts to isolate Damascus really didn't bear any fruit. The Europeans have been strongly reestablishing ties with Syria, economic ties. They're willing to sell Syria things that the Americans are not willing to countenance at the moment. And I think it fits in more broadly with President Barack Obama's wider strategy in the region of reaching out to countries with whom Washington has had rather testy relationships in the recent past. I think it's been a question very much of when, not if, America is going to restore ties with Damascus.
And meanwhile, the president has to manage some political blowback here at home for reestablishing ties with Syria. Jonathan Marcus from our partner, the BBC. Thank you. In other news, breast cancer survivors who take aspirin regularly may be 50% less likely to have the disease return. That's according to a long-term study of 4,000 women led by Harvard Medical School. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
At the Olympics in Vancouver,
representing the United States of America, Evan Lysacek.
American figure skater Evan Lysacek took second place in last night's skating short program. Russian Evgeny Fushenko took the number one slot. Of course, who wins and loses isn't what sparks the most conversation or even controversy. It's what they're wearing when they skate on the ice. Men's figure skater Johnny Weir, a three-time United States national champion, had a solid skate, but he came in sixth. He's been making some last-minute alterations to his uniform, Johnny Weir has, but it's because of pressure from political activists. And during the European Championships last month, the Russians' pair team wore uniforms that were inspired by what was supposed to make them look like Aboriginals from Australia. The outfits were so unpopular, so controversial, they decided to change them for the Olympics. Joining us now is Nick Varios, a man very familiar with the power of fashion for the ice. Varios is a fashion designer, but his work has been featured on Project Runway, and he's regularly seen at red carpet events like the Oscars. So, Nick, did you see these Aboriginal costumes?
Yes. Yeah, well, the operative word is it's supposed to look like Aboriginal costumes. Yes, Dominina and Shabalin, the 2009 world champions from Russia, they did an original dance, an Aboriginal dance, and, you know, besides the controversy part of it, I just thought they were ugly, to be quite honest. You know, I understood what they were going for, I just don't think they achieved it. I do think that in terms of the controversy and whether or not it was culture-specific, I do think that they went a little too far by doing the darker skin-toned body suits, whereas, you know, they're very pale, and I think that they should have just stayed that color. But by doing that, it was almost like they were going into the quote-unquote blackface category, and that's
well, they
where
did
I
darken
the
their faces.
Yeah, definitely. Yes, exactly.
But you know, Nick Varios, this calls into question the place in which cultural sensitivity and fashion collide, and that's brought up by the other controversy going on, which is over the use of fur on Johnny Ware's costume.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Johnny Ware. Always causing controversy, Johnny.
Right. He likes to do that. But in this particular case, there's a lot of people who are who have trouble with the fact that he's got fur on his mm-hmm. costume. It's got some activist groups up in arms. And again, this is
yes.
a problem. When you choose what to wear, you wouldn't think it's going to cause this kind of commotion where you're getting letters from nonprofit organizations. But it does.
But it does. It does. You know, I'm glad that people are paying attention to figure skating, you know, even though it is for controversial reasons. But I'm sure that the industry leaders and professionals would like to not have the controversy be about the costumes, but be more about the sport and the athleticism of it. But yeah, Johnny Ware always, you know, has to cause some controversy. I do think that he's reverted back to...
Yeah, he's changed his
hopefully,
mind.
Hopefully changed his mind, which is good. I think he just doesn't want to get pelted for
that
reason.
That would make it hard to skate.
Yes. It's one thing having red paint. It's another thing having red Swarovski crystals. Stoles, darling.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting to hear you, who is someone who's very concerned with fashion, talk about focusing more on the athleticism, because there has also been a number of discussions about whether or not the ice skating uniforms are becoming too body-bearing.
Oh, well, you know, I have to say that there was a bit of a controversy, especially with Evan Lysacek. Recently, in one of his championships that he did, he wore a rather revealing Vera Wang. He's also gone with Vera Wang. She designed several costumes for him where most of his torso and six-pack ab was showing. and I guess that caused a bit of a controversy, and he never used it again. But, you know, I do think that it's interesting to show both the beauty of the athleticism, you know, and the art of figure skating as well. And it would be so boring to see them just in you know, bland jumpsuits. So I do think it's great to see the sequins and to show a little bit of skin, as long as it's appropriate for the figure skating, you know, themselves, and as long as that they're being culturally sensitive.
What's the different challenges when you go to design a skating costume?
It's really close to what we call haute couture, which is high fashion. So it's a lot of, you know, doing gowns or dresses that are one of a kind, basically. And that's the same process that I think when I'm doing something for figure skating, because you really work one-on-one with the client. Especially with figure skating, you talk about the music and the person, and if it's appropriate for them, you know, something, a neckline that could be appropriate for somebody else might not necessarily be appropriate for them. But everything is one of a kind. The sequins are hand-sewn. The fabric is specially picked. You know, you don't just go to the 99-cent fabric store and buy some fabric and glue on some sequins and call it a day.
Well, I'm wondering if you had a specific skaters from the past that you looked to as being particularly having particularly good taste in their costumes. I mean, you look back at Dorothy Hamill or maybe Oksana Bayul. Does anybody from the past have good taste on the ice?
Well, I don't know if Oksana Bayul would come in under the good taste category, but definitely uh-oh. Michelle Kwan. Uh-oh. But definitely Michelle Kwan is one of my favorites, especially because she's one of the first figure skaters who started working with actual fashion designers such as Vera Wang and, you know, collaborating and making one-of-a-kind costumes for her, not just for nationals, but as well as for the Olympic figure skating. So definitely her. I'm a big fan of Sasha Cohen. When I was on a show called Project Runway in season two, we had a wonderful challenge, which we had to design a figure skating costume for Sasha. So after I did that, it was like done and done, as they say.
Are we going to see any Nick Varios originals on the ice in Vancouver?
Well, we might. I can't really talk about it, but I did meet earlier or late last year. I did meet with Rachel Flatt, our reigning U.S. national champion, and she was a doll with a capital D. Wonderful to talk to, and you know, of course, I profess my. Love of figure skating and love of designing costumes. And so we discussed a little here and there in terms of designing costumes. So you might see a Nick Varios original, but I have lawyers that are preventing me from saying anything.
Those lawyers, they're sticky that way. Okay, well, Nick Varios, will you come back after you've seen more of the fashions and let us know what you thought?
Oh, of course. I would love to. Thank you very much for having me.
Nick Verio. So fashion designer's work's been featured on Project Runway and is regularly seen at red carpet events like the Oscars. Thanks so much for joining us. Nick has given us his picks, actually, for all the all-time best and worst figure skating costumes. You can see them with photographs of them on our website, thetakeaway.org.
Well, speaking of best and worst, we want to hear who you think is having a good week and a bad week. We tally it up every Friday with our friends from The Week magazine. Give us your suggestions by calling 8778-MYTAKE and tune in to hear whether your picks match up with their picks. That's every Friday. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry all this week.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.